Podcast. I am Jason Smith, and with me today, he's one of our favorite guests, Curtis Harris of Brewups History. Curtis, welcome back to the show.
Yep. Always great to be here, Jason.
And I think you joked on Twitter that people only invite you to things whenever there's a sad occasion. And we've had you here on happy occasions as well, but it is unfortunately another sad occasion as the great Connie Hawkins, he died a few days ago. And, he's a guy where definitely you want to bring in someone who is well-versed in basketball history to share some insight on what made him so remarkable and so special. And, obviously, I think the guys that came along later that he was often compared to are someone like Julius Irving and Michael Jordan, just in terms of, combining the high flying, the aerobatics, the combination of grace and fury of, being able to dunk effectively and, make all these awesome moves, and also, being a great playmaker as well, which I think really he stood out even more than Irving and Jordan did. What are some of the things that stand out to you in terms of Hawkins, in terms of legacy and or style?
Well, first off, I like to say that other podcasts only invite me on when people die. You guys invite me whenever if something interesting happens. But with Connie Hawkins, I would say that he was definitely one of the first offensive high flyers in how he played, because other guys like Bill Russell had, made the game, aerial in terms of defense. But another guy like Elgin Baylor, he wasn't quite vertical. He was more like horizontal as how he elevated the game, because he didn't really dunk a lot. He would do more of the, double clutches and hang time stuff and kind of gliding toward the basket. But Connie Hawkins was definitely one of the first guys that really did, take off and fly in for a dunk. He had the enormous hands, and that's where the Julius Irving comparisons are really, really apt, because, he just had enormous hands. Like, I posted a, good God, I always forget the right pronunciation, GIF or JIF, whatever the hell.
Yeah.
I posted an image on Twitter of him just like, swinging the ball around with his giant hand. It's like a baseball in his hand, because his hands are so huge. And just faking people out that way. And I would say for anybody who hasn't seen any of his highlights, this is still a dated reference, but if you've seen Dr. J and George Gervin, I would say Connie Hawkins' offensive style was a combination of those two, because he did have the big dunks, but also had a lot of good finger rolls as well. And if I remember right, I think George Gervin gave an interview one time where he said, the guy that inspired him with the finger roll was Wilt Chamberlain and Connie Hawkins, because Wilt had to kind of like the not quite the same kind of finger roll, but he had like the huge hands. He kind of just flip it and he kind of do the big twist. But Connie Hawkins had the aerial, moving between players and swinging the ball around and do the little flip. So I'd say that'd probably be his most obvious contribution to how basketball was played. It was just the aerial, the acrobatic, the dunks, the way he would palm the basketball. Because I've never seen anybody except for Wilt Chamberlain, but Wilt was just like, 7 feet one and so enormous in every way. But besides Wilt, I think Connie Hawkins was the first player to really palm the basketball in that way. And just move the ball around that kind of fashion. So that, the dunking, the finger rolls, those are his biggest contributions. They're pretty obvious.
Yeah, I mean, his ability to be able to hold on to the ball and like swing around and do those really cool ball fakes, and whether he's dumping it off or about to make a move or whatever.
Yeah, no, it reminded me, it reminds me of Trace McGrady, the way he would kind of palm the basketball and swing it around like that. So I guess that's a more modern comparison. How T-Mac used to kind of hold it and move the ball around to swing it around and then, dump it off to a player who's cutting, or then, make his own offensive move off the dribble. Connie Hawkins would do stuff like that too.
Yeah, it's hard because, there are so many different, first of all, our footage of Hawkins is limited. But there's some good stuff out there. There's been some stuff that's been shared in the last couple of days. Of course, Wilt Chamberlain Archive always has good stuff. And there's, the NBA, and they have some highlights packages. So you definitely get a sense of it. But obviously the major theme of Hawkins's career is he was unjustly, you know, banned from the NBA for a, you know, very tenuous connection to a gambling scandal that he really had nothing involved in. We'll get into the details of that in a little bit, but you know, that basically took him out of organized, at least the NBA, for, you know, till he was in his late 20s, and, you know, did a little bit of, had a couple years in the ABA once that came to fruition, also was involved in another league called the ABL, which we'll get into a little bit. But the main highlights in terms of accomplishments of his career, he was actually the MVP in two leagues, the aforementioned ABL and ABA, and was four times first team in various leagues, including the NBA's first season there. Led the Pittsburgh Pipers to the ABA championship in the league's first season. He also had stints with the Harlem Globetrotters for several years and was a playground legend in New York City, including, of course, New York's famous Rucker Park.
Yeah, no, I think that's kind of the overview that people should know. Also, you know, we'll get to it in a little bit, but, you know, his high school playing days too. So that, not just a pickup ball, but there's a great article, which I remember the guy who wrote it, but there's a great article that was written about the high school basketball game that he and Roger Brown had against each other, and just the hype that was built up around that. So he was a huge, one of the most highly recruited high school basketball players back at that time, too. So people knew about him. He was one of the big time recruits back in the early 60s at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he was repeatedly could dunk a basketball at the age of 11, and you know, was already, you know, pretty famous on the playgrounds in his teen years. He grew up in the I'm going to butcher the pronunciation probably, but the Bedford
Stuyvesant. Okay. I think Stuyvesant's how it's pronounced.
Gotcha. Yeah. In Brooklyn, and came from a very poor family. His mother was blind, and he was one of, I think, five of brothers, and I think they were all brothers. And you know, was you had a rough, you know, bit of a rough upbringing. You didn't do necessarily well in school. Later on, he would you know, would work hard and had some help with tutors, and would, you know, be able to get kind of his reading up, but it was really, you really struggled academically there. But in basketball, he was very extremely successful at Boys High School, as you talked about. There was a Madison Square Garden playoff showdown with Roger Brown, who, of course, would also be a great ABA star, would also be blackballed unfairly by gambling scandals. So it really interesting parallels between them, but had a fantastic duel. Actually, Hawkins only had 18 points and 13 rebounds, fouling out in the third quarter. Roger Brown scored 39, but it was actually the Boys High School team that won there, and they were able to win their second consecutive PSAL championship, although they lost in the finals of the city high school championships there. But yeah, as a junior and as a senior, he was, you know, incredibly successful in his school, and before then was, you know, was well known, you know, throughout, you know, playgrounds and so forth. And obviously in school was still a successful playground player, but and then was, you know, was heavily recruited, as you mentioned, ended up going to the University of Iowa and playing on the freshman team there, and was the University of Iowa, it was a pretty successful program there. They had Don Nelson, but the freshman team with Connie would routinely beat the regular team, which had, you know, Don Nelson and others. So they were, he was already successful there, but it was there where he got linked to a gambler named Jack Molinas, who had been a former NBA star who had been banned from the NBA after extensively found to be really, really deeply involved in a betting. And there's a really good book called The Wizard of Odds that details all of this, and there's lots of articles about it too. But Jack Molinas was quite a there was quite a huge scandal that he was linked to, along with a lot of other people, in the early 50s in college basketball, which really did a lot of damage to New York and college basketball throughout the country. And then in the early 60s again, Molinas was one. He was a lawyer at the time, and he was involved in another one, which he later got involved in prison. A lot of people who were, you know, involved in gambling and not involved in gambling got trapped in it, including Hawkins, who really only thing that he did was was borrow about $200 from Molinas and was not involved in any gambling or anything like that. Now he, you know, there were other NCAA things involving, you know, he took some money and things like that. That was common at the time. And honestly is pretty common today as we've seen, but
Yeah.
I mean,
very common current FBI indictments.
Yes, exactly. Yes. We both could rail on about the hypocrisy of the NCAA system and so forth. But is there anything that you want to add about kind of the context of, you know, what was going on in terms of that scandal in the early 60s?
Yeah, I think like Connie Hawkins is really one of the most important players or people to really study if you want to know what basketball in its whole history is, because we've already discussed his kind of stylistic impact on basketball. But he also, his career, what he went through in his life revealed some of the, the shittiness that goes on with a, you know, a system where things could be made off of it. So, you know, starting with Jack Molinas, you know, back in the late 40s, early 50s, there's several gambling, corruption scandals that happened in the NCAA, and then it came into the NBA. So basketball really had kind of a black eye coming off of that. Again, you know, it began in the NCAA, but it reached into the NBA. So you had guys like Molinas, Alex Groza, Ralph Beer, they're all banned for various connections with gambling. And I think that's why the NBA really, I mean, I think they went overboard with those guys, except for Molinas. Molinas probably did deserve to get banned for life because he actually was gambling on games in the NBA while he was playing in the NBA.
Right.
But Alex Groza and Ralph Beer, they were kind of pushed aside, I think, a bit unjustly. They deserved a suspension, but not like a lifelong ban. But the NBA is still reeling off of that. You know, it's only about a decade later when, you know, Connie Hawkins and Roger Brown and Doug Moe and other guys kind of get caught up in the Jack Molinas web. You know, anything related with Molinas was just like the NBA didn't want anything to do with it because of the perception that would kind of bring up again. No matter how flimsy the evidence, no matter how tenuous the connections were, and so yeah, the NBA just had like a fear at that point. They wanted to be, you know, kind of on the level, on the up and up, no more corruption, no more gambling. So Hawkins, Brown, Doug Moe, they suffered because of that. If the NBA had, I know this is some like a weird what if, but like, you know, if they had did not have the Jack Molinas problem and Connie Hawkins and the other guys might have had a similar situation go down, they maybe it might have looked the other way, just be like, whatever, you know, like we'll just keep it hush like we do, like we keep it hush with the NCAA money that they were getting all the time. But that bigger context is needed because you kind of realize in the, from the bigger scope that the NBA was, again, you know, just only a decade old at that point. So they were really afraid, like, you know, this we might not be permanent. You know, there have been plenty of basketball leagues that have been around for only a decade and they fold. So the NBA wanted to keep it running. So, you know, Hawkins was a sacrifice to keep the league running. So, yeah, I guess that's what I would add at that point what Hawkins reveals about that and then how it took him. Almost a day to get into the NBA. So we talked about the ABL, the ABA, but he also filed a lawsuit eventually, I think like maybe 66 or 67 against the NBA. Then he got it settled by 1969. So he also shows you kind of the strength eventually the players decided to take up against the NBA, the revolt basically they had on a number of areas. So Hawkins was just one another example of the guys that were pushing back. You know, the famous 64 All-Star Game strike, and then they threatened to strike, I think, the 68 playoffs. So he was just another example of the players, you know, finally rising up against the owners, you know, and realizing they're being treated unfairly in a number of ways. So his story really just encapsulates a lot of the important things that were happening at that point in the NBA and in basketball overall.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely, that's well said. And, you know, you can understand the NBA's point of view to a certain extent of, like, you know, there is some fear of that gambling could bring the whole thing down. I mean, it was really, really damaging in the NCAA in the early 50s. Other than Molinas, really, in the NBA, there wasn't a huge effect, because the league, no one really cared about the NBA when that happened. And what was going on there was relatively minor compared to the NCAA scandal. So they kind of got away out of that. And so I can see from their point of view why they would be punitive of any kind of connection at all they would want to, you know, do. But obviously, you know, Hawkins, you know, again, later demonstrated that he basically had, you know, nothing to do with that. And yeah, I mean, it's really looking at the details of, you know, what actually happened there. you know, he's at Iowa, and then suddenly there are detectives who come in. You know, this is 1960 and, or I'm sorry, this is 61. And then, he basically is taken back to New York and he's gone for 2 weeks and he's basically like held without being charged there for like 2 weeks and basically like forced to eventually, just confess, or well, basically make a false confession of, you know, telling them what they wanted to hear. At that point, you know, he was never charged, but at that point, you know, he was, I don't know if he was formally expelled from Iowa or if he just was just basically not invited back, but either way, he was,
however they formulated it, he was not going back to university. And yeah, I'm glad you brought up the police questioning, because, you know, that, you know, I guess a whole other subject, you know, about how, you know, a poor black person from New York is treated by the police back then. You know, you just hold up for 2 weeks and you get no representation from counsel. Then the police are just questioning you. And I think he said up to 8 hours a day the police were trying to question him. So like anybody being interrogated for 8 hours straight, you'll start saying funny stuff or just confessing the stuff. You'll just have the interrogation stop. So,
right.
Like, yeah, that would never hold up in court. That's why I never went to court. So, but the damage with him was done. He didn't need to go to court to have the damage done. So, yeah, his career got ruined by that.
Yeah. So he, you know, he couldn't go back to any, you know, another university was going to take him. And the NBA basically let it be known that he wasn't officially banned until 66, but they basically said, like, yeah, we're not going to approve any contract for him to come in. So, fortunately for Hawkins, a new league called the American Basketball League formed the next year. It was formed by the Abe Saperstein, who was the Harlem Globetrotters owner, apparently had been promised an NBA franchise, and that didn't come to fruition. So he started a rival league, you know, with some of the other leagues that were smaller leagues that were going on in the time, and industrial leagues and so forth, where there was still, you know, some pretty high-level basketball going on, and they were able to, you know, form a pretty competitively. They had a few notable, you know, NBA players such as Dick Barnett, Kenny Sears, Larry Siegfried, Bill Bridges, Nat Clifton, and George Yardley, who had been one of the first, you know, really big scorers for the NBA in the mid to late 50s. George Steinbrenner was one of the owners of the franchise, which had a team in Cleveland. Probably best known today for the first professional league having a three-pointer and also having a wider foul line that the NBA soon adopted. And there's an interesting story about Pittsburgh Wrens owner Lenny Littman, who would be the Littman family would be important in Hawkins' life going forward. But he basically showed up. He was a Pittsburgh concert entertainment promoter, and he showed up at Hawkins' home unannounced and had a contract, and then brought him into the league. And he was really dominant at first. And in fact, they other ABL owners like thought, you know, wanted to try to get him barred because of the gambling connection, said that his signing violated league rules also because, you know, his college class had not yet graduated, but then they ended up coming up, he was ruled eligible by Saperstein, who was in charge, and you know, ended up being the MVP of the league that year at only age 19.
Yeah, this, you know, this teases out another angle on, again, like, you know, you study Connie Hawkins, you pretty get a pretty good idea of basketball history this era. Like, yeah, he's still the ABL, upstart, rival to the NBA, and how Abe Saperstein thought he got screwed by the NBA. You know, he was apparently promised a franchise in Chicago, or actually, no, it was Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, yeah.
But they didn't, yeah, but then the Lakers, you know, beat him to the punch. So he was like, screw this, I'm going to form my own league. And, yeah, they start. That's the first cracks in the dam, I guess you can say, for the control that the NBA had over the players. So a guy like Connie Hawkins could, you know, like you said, at 19 years of age, wait till his college class graduated, go into pro league and be the MVP, win the championship. I think he averaged 28 points. But also, as you said, you know, he had guys like Dick Barnett, George Yardley, these other guys who have been all-stars, or would be all-stars in the NBA. So there's definitely some talent in there. And one other guy you mentioned, Kenny Sears, him and Dick Barnett, they had lawsuits with the NBA about whether or not they could join the ABL. So you kind of have the precursor of the ABA stuff, you know, 7 years before all that happened. So that's just a really interesting league. And Connie Hawkins was the dominant player in the league. Unfortunately, only lasted one season. So you wish he could have kept going and he could have, you know, played in an actual professional league for a good while. And people really would have had more of an idea as to how good he was. But the league folded the next year, and they didn't even make it at 63. I think they folded in all the 62, and he had to join the Globetrotters. So
yeah. I mean, he felt fortunate that at least, you know, he was able to join the Globetrotters there, and I guess was there from like 63 to 67. I couldn't find a whole lot on his time with the Globetrotters. You know, if there's much interesting there, obviously the Globetrotters are, there's an interesting story, you know, with them and what they were doing at the time. But, obviously it would have been better for him to be, you know, among the best competition in the world rather than, you know, doing what the Globetrotters were doing.
Yeah, by the mid-60s, they still had some talented players. Yeah, they were definitely more on the joke side, less on the competitive basketball side at that point.
Yeah, and you know, back in the 40s and 50s, I mean, the showmanship aspect was always a part of the Globetrotters, but they were generally playing, you know, against high-level competition and in serious games. I'm not exactly sure at what point it really transitioned to the to more of the antics, probably as the NBA, you know, kind of established itself more and there was an actual professional basketball league and they were, you know, there was African-American talent that was going into that league that probably obviously that sort of changed the game for the Globetrotters. He was his class was eligible in the 64 draft. No team selected him. He also went undrafted in 65. It was funny that the NBA actually claimed that each team decided unilaterally didn't want him rather than it being some sort of conspiracy against him. Eventually after 66, he was voted by the Board of Governors to be barred, which actually led to the lawsuit that you alluded to earlier, which was it was actually filed by the Littman family. It was Pittsburgh attorneys Dave and Roz Littman, who were friends of his. I'm not sure of the exact relation to the owner of the Wrens franchise, but anyway, they filed a $6 million antitrust suit there, eventually was able to was awarded a $1.3 million settlement and had a contract with the Suns. So ended up being successful to that. We'll kind of get into that in a little bit, but before that happened, he joined another fledgling league called the ABA and had quite a bit of success there.
It's kind of it's not officially, but in essence, it's kind of like the reincarnation of the ABL. Another upstart league trying to challenge the NBA and obviously more successful than the ABL. I'm just really glad that the ABA came around because they gave the guys like Hawkins and Roger Brown and Doug Moe and just other players like Freddie Lewis and Larry Jones, these other guys that, you know, just didn't make an NBA roster for whatever reason, but they were really, really good players. So they were able to actually show what they could do in the ABA. But Dan Hawkins was the dominant player. And at this point, he was 27 years old. So, you know, we're now talking like almost a decade at this point where he got, you know, kicked out of Iowa at 19 years of age. Now he's 27 years old and again, the ABA. And he just absolutely dominates the league. I think he averaged 28 points again like he did in the ABL. And again, it takes a Pittsburgh team all the way to the finals, and they won a really tough seven-game series over the New Orleans Buccaneers that had Doug Moe and Larry Brown. That's like the backcourt. It's just Doug Moe played forward, but Larry Brown played point guard. And like it's just fantastic to kind of look back at that, like knowing where all these guys kind of went to later on, and just thinking about them playing against Connie Hawkins and just a tremendous series he had. And looking at his stats, it shows you his all-around game that we're talking about. It was 27 points, 13.5 rebounds, and 4.5 assists per game. And so he wasn't just a scorer. He was a really good passer. And also, with the jumping ability, a really good rebounder at that point. So it's really good that he got that chance like the guy did to finally show what they could do in a real professional league, even though this was just getting started at that point. That kind of gave him the platform, I think, and kind of forced the NBA's hand, where the court decision was going to be the way it was. But I think it kind of expedited things, where the NBA owners could see, like, all right, we have this from this other league, and they could actually see what Hawkins was able to do. So it really wasn't any sense in fighting this trial. They were probably going to lose at the end of the day. So that's why they settled by 69 and just let Hawkins join the NBA. So
it was good for the ABA, good for Hawkins, and helped force his way into the NBA by getting that chance in the ABA.
So yeah, Hawkins. You mentioned his numbers in that first year, but yeah, he led the league in scoring, was second in the league in rebounding, and third in assists per game. So really, all across the board was, you know, doing everything that you'd want to do. Yeah, he had 17.9 win shares that year, and the second in the league was Larry Jones of Denver with 11.8. So that's a pretty huge disparity there. Yeah, and the interesting thing about him is that, you know, his teammates, a lot of them talked about how unselfish he was. Like, he didn't even lead the team in shots that year. I think the guards there, Chico Vaughn and Charlie Williams, actually took more shots than he did, which is kind of amazing. Now, both of them were shooting a lot of threes that year. They were one of the first teams to really embrace the three, but that's pretty impressive right there. And says something about, you know, Hawkins' game.
Yeah, I was about to say Chico Vaughn. Yeah, he was launching three pointers.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm trying to remember if he played. I don't think he did. I'm trying to remember the guy. It's not the time for it, but there was one guy in the ABL, guy who was chucking up a whole bunch of three pointers. I wish I could remember his name off the top of my head. But yeah, no. You read the quotes from his teammates in Pittsburgh. They would say, like, yeah, Connie could average, over 30, maybe 40. And then he started to embellish, like maybe 50 points a game. It was like, all right, we don't need to go that far. But he could have averaged more than 27 points. But yeah, they were like, but he was a team player. He wanted other guys to be involved. And they said he was a good help defender as well, which, you know, given his frame, like he's a 6'8", 4 with those long arms and big hands. Like, he would be the prototypical help defender, you know, trap a guy, get into a passing lane. So, he was more just a scorer. He was a really good passer, rebounder, good help defender, and also a great teammate, according to those guys who were with Pittsburgh. So, yeah, it was really good to read their stories. Loose balls, as usual, has the good info on the ABA stuff.
Absolutely. So, in the second year for the Pipers, they ended up leaving for Minnesota for inexplicable reasons.
That's unfortunate.
Yes. So, the reputedly is because George Mikan, who was the ABA president and was headquartered in Minnesota, wanted to have a team there after the first team left. But either way, it was not a great decision. They sort of failed there and moved back to Pittsburgh. But at this point, it was without Hawkins, who, as you talked about, there was a settlement of his lawsuit. One of the big things that was the impetus for this is there was a Life magazine story that was written by David Wolf, who would later turn that story into the book Foul, that would, you know, talk about, you know, the injustices that were done against him in the case and all that good stuff. And that sort of brought public opinion on Connie Hawkins' side. That was, it got a lot of attention during that time, and that kind of paved the way for, as you mentioned, the lawsuit to be settled. And he would eventually, Phoenix would get his rights based on a secret coin flip that they won against the Seattle Supersonics. So the Suns.
See, I never knew that. I was always wondering how. The Suns got his rights, because, like, they never drafted him. Yeah. All right, secret coin flips. All right.
Yeah, there you go. It wasn't just the ABA was doing the secret coin flips. It was the NBA was involved as well. Yeah, because of course Phoenix had famously lost the coin flip to the Bucks for Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. So yeah, so you know they got what. I mean, Connie Hawkins is not a bad consolation prize.
At that point, and I got ages mixed up. When he joined the ABA, he was 25. When he joined the NBA, he was 27. So I got a little ahead of myself a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, unfortunately, by that point, he did have that knee injury in his second season in the ABA. So yeah, when they were the Minnesota Piper, the second year of the ABA, he had a knee injury. So unfortunately, he's already like getting into his late 20s. So like your athleticism is already declining. But that knee injury. You still got good Connie Hawkins in the ABA, but it wasn't quite, you know, the full force and freak of nature that he was back in the ABA and ABL at that point.
Yeah, that first year he still, you know, was probably like a top 10 player in the league. In fact, he was all NBA first team, but and he was still good for a few years, but it was clearly – Yeah, the knee injury, you know, all those years playing in, you know, on subpar courts, and you know the travel. I'm sure that was rough. You know, with the Globetrotters and with you know, playgrounds and all that stuff was probably, you know, adding up for him. But yeah, I mean, people talked about you know, when he first got there, about how, you know, Jerry Colangelo, who was the Suns GM at the time, I think was actually coach for a little while as well. He said, you know, that really Hawkins was there, you know, putting them on the map. And, you know, the guys he was playing against, like, you know, Dave DeBuscher and Billy Cunningham were, you know, like, wowing, you know, how, you know, great he was playing. You know, Billy Cunningham had actually played against him in you know, back in the days in New York during the, you know, they were similar ages, you know, playing there in Brooklyn. And, you know, DeBuscher was talking about how, you know, he handled the ball like it was a baseball. And Bill Russell picked a all-time, all-pro team, and Hawkins was on his second five. And then he said, he said, you know, if he hadn't gotten such a bad deal, you would mention Hawkins with Baylor and Pettit. So seeing his talent on that same level, but obviously not quite having the same ability to display it. But yeah, that first year, he was sixth in the league in scoring. He was like top 10 in PER and win shares, and he led the Suns to a 23-game improvement over the previous year in their first playoff spot and only their second year in the league. So yeah, I mean, I would say that first year was really the standout year. In his final game of his rookie season, he had 44 points, 20 rebounds, 8 assists, and unofficially 5 blocks and 5 steals, and had, you know, one of his best games in the in game 2 of the 1970 playoff series against the Lakers. This was the Chamberlain, Russell, and Chamberlain, West, and Baylor Lakers, where he had 34 points, 20 rebounds, 7 assists, and the Lakers were heavily favored, but the Suns ended up winning game 2 and going up 3-1 in that series, although they ended up losing it in game 7 to the Lakers there.
Yeah, that's hilarious. The Suns were 39-43, so they had a losing record, which is, it was an improvement, as you said, but they still had a slightly losing record, and almost beat, like, the defending Western Conference champion L.A. Lakers. So Connie was still doing the thing his first year in the NBA. But yeah, as we've said, you know, the courts caught up with him, the knee stuff. So the next year, I mean, the Suns are still a really good team. In fact, they're even better the next season. But this is the stupidity of the NBA. They won 39 games in 1970. And almost beat the Lakers in the playoffs. But then the next year, they won 48 games, but didn't qualify for the playoffs.
Yeah, that was still...
This is geographical nonsense at the NBA.
Right, and that was even worse then, because that was the time where they were doing it based on... Because they just split from divisions and into conferences, and so there were four divisions, and it was the top two from each division that made the playoffs. So it wasn't even just based on conference. So they were... Yeah, they were 48-34 that year and did not make the playoffs. And
the damn San Francisco Warriors. I'm looking at it right now. The San Francisco Warriors, 41-41.
Right, made it. Yeah, exactly. So
and the Detroit Pistons were 45. They're in the West at that time, but they were 45-37. So the freaking San Francisco Warriors with 41 wins got in the playoffs over the Detroit Pistons and the Phoenix Suns, who had more wins. So the NBA has never had. All right. Has always had issues with playoffs and scheduling. We'll just leave it at
go ahead.
It's like, again, the Connie Hawkins story reveals a lot of interesting things about basketball history.
Yeah, they did get rid of that rule after a little while. It got a little better. I mean, you know, the there are still obviously issues occasionally, but that was a really egregious, like, what are they thinking kind of thing. So yeah, and his numbers did slip a little bit to the next couple of that second year. He did average 21 points per game. He was still pretty. The rebounding was down a bit, but he was still, you know, pretty efficient scorer and such. And that third year, the numbers definitely went down. You know, only 16 points a game at age 30. So that one, you know, that was the year he kind of fell off a little bit, and people started to notice that, obviously. And even though the numbers were, you know, fairly good, you know, he came in with this, you know, a really big reputation, obviously, of you know, being this, you know, the greatest player who had never been in the league and so forth. And there was some, you know, there were some criticisms from writers and fans, and but I thought that Ray Scott, the Pistons coach, had a great quote there of saying, you know, if Connie Hawkins is slowed down, I wish he'd show it against us. So he could still show some of that, you know, good stuff going on there. But once he left Phoenix in 74, he was traded from the Suns to the Lakers. You know, there was a noticeable kind of downgrade there. The Lakers were, you know, okay in 74, even though it was Jerry West's final year. He only played 32 games, but they still had, you know, a fairly decent team there. They won 47 games. They, you know, they had Gail Goodrich and Happy Hairston, Elmore Smith, you know, some decent players. So they, but the numbers by then, it was like 10.8 points per game, 8 rebounds per game, you know. Well, that was in the playoff series against the Bucks, where, you know, this is Kareem's Bucks. He's still really strong, Oscar Robertson. They make the finals that year. So that was kind of the last gasp of, you know, of playoff relevance, at least for Hawkins.
Yeah. I mean, after that, he played, the rest of that, I mean, that one season with the Lakers, and he had another full year in 75. And then had the one forgettable year with the Atlanta Hawks. But had the nice symmetry, you know, Connie Hawkins playing for the Atlanta Hawks. I meant to say this earlier. I don't think any person has had a more perfect last name for how their style of play was. Like, isn't it perfect that his name was Connie Hawkins and he, like, flew around like a hawk on the court? Yes. That if ever there's proof, there's a guy. That's it. But
I believe you made the and you're right up on Connie Hawkins on Pro Hoops History. I believe you made his career rose from the ashes when he went to the Phoenix Suns. So there was I thought that was appropriate as well. You know,
there we go.
Yeah,
Connie has a way. He's very, very poetic. His career.
Yes.
But it did. But it ends in 70s. Actually, again, it ends in 76. That's when the ABA at the end of that year joins the NBA, merges with the NBA.
Right.
So there we go. That's, you know, Connie Hawkins' career. You know, high school, when he graduated in 1960, so he probably started high school like 1957. So that's a good 57 to 76. Just following Connie Hawkins' basketball life, you get a pretty good overview as to all the twists and turns in basketball as to what was going on. The college gambling, the undue suspensions and blackballings, the rival leagues, and finally the mergers and the lawsuits. But the stylistic and athletic changes in the game, the man's career has a pretty good, you know, bookends and all that, and that little 2-decade period.
Yeah. I found there's some interesting stories about his personality, because it's one thing I hadn't really ever gotten much of a sense of in looking at, you know, his career before, of, you know, kind of what, you know, I'd always kind of thought of him as like a little bit of a shy, reserved guy, and he was pretty quiet after his career ended. But there's a couple of fun anecdotes that I found reading. There's a couple from the Arizona Republic where Al McCoy, the longtime Suns announcer, noticed that he was missing from the game. And apparently he had, this was during the time which his autobiography came out in 72. And there was, he had a lot of media stuff and was just really exhausted after like a long road trip. And he had fallen asleep in the room of David Wolf, the book's author. And then he came in, got there at the arena, put his uniform on. It was the end of the first quarter. And, then McCoy asked him, like, hey, what's going on? Where you been? And then Hawkins turned around and he said, look at it this way. If this was baseball and a doubleheader, I'd be early for the second game. So he was a good there's another one from Joe Prosky, who was the Suns trainer, and said that Hawk is the guy who got me nicknamed Magic Fingers. One time we were playing on national TV and he fell down near the free throw line. I thought he was really hurt. He was grabbing his knee and grimacing in pain. I ran out and asked him what was wrong. He looks at me and says, just think, all your buddies in Green Bay, which was his hometown, are eating their hearts out because you're on national TV. Then he jumped up and Hot Rod Hundley, who was broadcasting the game, said, oh my God, he must have magic in his fingers. So there was a lot of quotes like that of guys who, you know, showing off kind of his sense of humor, and, you know, it seemed like a guy people enjoy being with and hanging out with. I guess the other thing that he's kind of known for outside of basketball, of course, is that Saturday Night Live sketch with Paul Simon, which I have not been able to find again. I know I saw it at some point, you know, when I was a kid. Not like live, obviously, like later on. I'm not that old, but
obviously.
Later on, would sometime on a rerun, I remember seeing that one. So that's a fun one with you playing with Paul Simon on the playground. And I guess the joke of it is like Simon is, you know, beating him, obviously, even though it's, you know, Simon against Connie Hawkins. So that was obviously that was toward the end of his career, maybe even slightly after he had retired.
Oh, yeah, if it's Saturday Night Live, yeah, it's got to be like this last year, or prior to he just retired. But
yeah.
Fair enough. What's his sense of humor? Or, you know, a good Hawk. Also, I want to add this in. If the listeners out there, if y'all know Andrew Lynch, a basketball writer, he apparently played poker with Johnny Hawkins. Ooh. In like 2006. And he was like, I think it was at a casino in Vegas. So they're just like at the same poker table. And that was just, they're like on the TV was Kobe Bryant scoring the 81 points. So like, if you want to hear more about it, go follow Andrew Lynch at Andrew Lynch on Twitter and ask about Connie Hawkins and poker and Kobe Bryant. He can tell you about playing poker with Connie Hawkins in 2006 when Kobe's dropping 81 points. So like, that's the story right there. When Andrew first told me about that, I was like, yeah, like you gotta be kidding me. He's like, no, I played poker with Connie Hawkins. Kobe scored 81 points. I was like, all right, you know. Some of us have great stories of basketball to tell. Some of us have that story like Andrew Lynch, which is, you know, beyond great. That is just, I don't know what it is beyond that. one of the greatest games ever played. You sit with one of the greatest players ever playing poker as the game is happening. So.
Yeah, that's pretty fantastic.
Great story.
I had not known that. Yeah, I'll ask him about that one because I'm very curious now about about that one for sure. Yeah. So yeah, there wasn't a whole lot on his what he was doing after basketball. You know, there's some kind of allusions in some of the articles that he went through some rough times. He did play in the first three NBA Legends old timers games in the 80s. And then in the early 90s, Jerry Colangelo, who was still an executive with the Suns, I think maybe partial owner at that point. But anyway, he brought Hawkins to be a community ambassador for the Suns, which he was doing up until, I think, fairly recently. You know, he really started to have some health problems in the late 2000s. And but I saw there were some photo galleries of him stuff, at least, you know, being involved and stuff, at least up until like 2015. So he really enjoyed being a community ambassador for it. And and then, of course, was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame in 1992. And he talked about how, you know, when he got that news in 91, you know, he was he cried and just thought of, like, you know, something, how fantastic it was. And it was really a huge feeling for me. And it made me think about that because, I mean, like, I'm not sure how much the Basketball Hall of Fame means to someone like, you know, like Michael Jordan or Julius Erving or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I mean, they all seem honored by that induction. But, I mean, you know, they are recognized as being, you know, the greatest, among the greatest players of all time at that level. And, you know, I don't know what it would mean to someone in Connie Hawkins' position, who is certainly one of the best ever, but didn't really get a full chance to prove it. Only got to prove it kind of in flashes. There's still a question of, like, okay, is he really one of the best 10, 15 ever? Or, you know, where does he kind of belong in that hierarchy of, you know, of basketball history? So I think the Hall of Fame, you know, adds some validation for a guy like that, or, you know, or a guy who is, you know, you could also talk about a guy who's, you know, kind of maybe like more of a borderline case, even if they had a full career. But for someone like Hawkins, I think there probably has to be a different feel for, you know, what that means, especially, you know, getting it so late after, you know, his career.
No, it definitely means, like, I mean, this is my interpretation, like hell, I'm not going to Basketball Hall of Fame. But, you know, for like you said, somebody like Kareem or Bill Russell or Michael Jordan, you are clearly acknowledged being one of the greatest players ever. There's never any doubt you're going into the Basketball Hall of Fame. And even a guy like, Grant Hill or Tracy McGrady, you know, McGrady who beat the Hall of Fame, and Grant Hill, who I would say probably it's in there. But even guys like them, like, their careers were kind of derailed by injury, whereas someone like Connie Hawkins and Roger Brown, who finally got inducted, albeit posthumously, for guys like them to get inducted, it is more of a validation that they had been, you know, unjustly, unduly denied their chance to prove what they fully could have done with their career. Whereas you know, McGrady, you know, had a chance, injury, you know, it wasn't, like, you know, that's just like, you know, fake, nothing you can do about that. Injuries happen. Whereas with Hawkins, actively stepped in and stopped him from being able to do what he was great at and made the most of his talent and fully display what he could have done. So I feel like the Hall of Fame induction was almost like an apology and a recognition that he had been done wrong, and that, you know, they took that into effect, and they know that if he had been able to do what he was fully capable of, there would be no doubt he would have been in the class of, you know, maybe not Michael Jordan and Kareem and Bill Russell, but in a class of whatever, hell, think of second-tier players, like whatever, George Gervin, just people like that, who you just never doubt are going to be in the Hall of Fame anyways, even as they're playing. So I think that's why for him, people like him, that means a lot. It's just, yeah, it's that validation, but also like that apology that, yes, we had done you wrong. Like the authority of basketball had done you wrong. Like, you know, the authorities have stepped in and stopped you from being able to do what your greatest talent was. So I think that's why it meant the most to him, and people like him.
So one thing we want to talk about, and Josh at Hoops Plus the Harm asked us this question specifically, and I know we wanted to have some discussion about it, of how would he have altered the NBA's trajectory had he played in his prime? That's a really interesting question to think about. So if he'd have been drafted in 1964, that would have been his draft class. So he would have either been the territorial or the Knicks, who had the first pick outside of the territorial picks. He would have certainly, almost certainly gone to the Knicks. They would not have drafted Jim Barnes in the first round. And if they'd have selected Willis Reed in the second round, as they did that year, you know, obviously a Knicks team anchored by Hawkins and Reed is really interesting to think about how they would have progressed from there, because obviously they're certainly a better team right away. And how do they, you know, they obviously build a much different team than the Knicks of the, you know, early 70s would have been, but I could see a team based on those two guys obviously having a lot of success, probably even a little bit earlier than they did.
Yeah, see, I was thinking along your lines, but at that point, the New York Knicks were kind of a little incompetent. I think they might have still Jim Barnes number one overall, because there was like a 5-year stretch. They drafted nothing but centers with their first round picks. So maybe they would have wisened up and took Connie Hawkins because he was from New York City. But I don't know. Like you can only correct stupid so much. And I think they might have still took Jim Barnes. Not that Jim Barnes was a bad player, but you clearly should have took Connie Hawkins over him.
Yeah.
I mean, they took Jim Barnes over Willis Reed. So they got lucky that no one else took Willis Reed and got him in the second round. So I would hope the Knicks would have took Connie Hawkins. And that would make for a really interesting team, as you said. But if they didn't take him, like Baltimore, they were sitting there at number three. They took this man named Gary Brad, who I've never heard of. He played 44 games in the NBA.
Hey, he's in Ohio.
He was a small four.
Yeah, he played Ohio State. You know, I'm sure he was great. Yeah,
I'm sure he was, but he played small four. Yeah. I feel like the Baltimore Bullets, but they're looking for a small four, they probably would have took Connie Hawkins at that point. So, yeah. Like, throw him in with Gus Johnson and all those guys up there, that would have been an interesting team, too. So, basically, well, the bottom line is whoever would have took him would have had a hell of a team. They've got a whole lot better. NBA would have been a lot more exciting. And along with the Connie Hawkins, like I keep mentioning him, like, he's in lockstep because he got a lot of crap. But Roger Brown, he would have been a territorial pick, no doubt about it, of the Cincinnati Royals.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like a man, and like Oscar Robertson knew Roger Brown. So I'm sure Oscar would have told Cincinnati, y'all better take Roger Brown in this draft. And like, imagine a freaking backcourt of Oscar Robertson and Roger Brown in Cincinnati with Jerry Lewis and Wayne Embry and all those other guys. Like, that team, they might beat Boston in the Eastern Conference if they had that together. Well, they were still in the West. That's the problem. But they would have died, I guess. But now Cincinnati would have been a title contender. And then, you know, depending on who got Connie Hawkins, the Knicks probably would have been so, but the Bullets.
Yeah,
they might have been able to get to the level a little more iffy with Connie, because it depends on who took him. But they could have been a contender. I could guess a dark horse contender at that point.
Yeah, I'm looking at, I mean, obviously Joe Caldwell was really good, but looking at whether the Pistons would have taken would have taken Hawkins instead of Caldwell. Now, that, I guess they had DeBuscher. Well, yeah, I guess Connie was more of a small forward. So they with DeBuscher and Connie and Terry Dischinger there, I mean, that's Ray Scott, too. That's an interesting team. I mean, and that's, you know, the Pistons were pretty much, I mean, they were really, you know, either mediocre or bad pretty much from the late 50s through the mid 80s. So, you know, up until the first year, they kind of got good with Isaiah and Laimbeer and those guys. So I, it'd be interesting if they would have had a little
bit of spurt
there. Yeah. I'm sorry. Did
I miss something? Let's not disparage her you disparage Dave Bing and Bob Lear. They had like 3 years of success.
Well, okay. I mean, they were like 45 win team. I mean, yeah. I mean, they were great players, but that was not, you know.
Let's not forget that they did have a couple of good years.
Okay.
But overall, you're correct. They did suck from like 59 to 85.
Yeah.
But
right.
The three glorious years, Bob Lear and Dave Bing, got them out the gutter.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a fair point. You know, it's like, that's a fair point. Yeah. They got screwed out of that whole seeding thing that we talked about. They got screwed out of the seeding issue 1 year for where they should have made the playoffs with a lot of wins and they didn't. So I walk back a little bit of what I said.
Yeah, that's walking back. I stick up for Dave being a Bob Lanier.
Yeah. Religiously, you should. That's fair. It's not unfair. They're wonderful. So, yeah.
You know what would have been interesting? Let's say, because I feel like the Knicks still would have been stupid.
Okay.
And the Pistons still would have took Joe Caldwell, because, like, Caldwell's a really good player, and he fit the need they had. So they could have took Hawkins or Joe Caldwell. And if Baltimore was still stupid, it was like, no, Gary Bratt's a small forward we need.
Yeah.
Sitting at number four were the Philadelphia 76ers. They took Luke Jackson.
Yeah.
Because they were looking for a center. So they probably would have stuck with him because they didn't have Will Chamberlain yet. They traded for him midway that next season.
Right.
But then the St. Louis Hawks, they took Jeff Mullins, who was a shooting guard small forward. That would have been interesting. They had gotten Connie Hawkins in St. Louis. Because if he would have graduated from Iowa, I feel like St. Louis would be like, all right, that's a kid from Iowa. We could take him and add him into our front line that had Zelmo Beatty and Bill Bridges. And also Paul Silas coming off the bench. So, like, that would have been a hell of a front court to have Bill Bridges, Zelmo Beatty, Connie Hawkins, and Paul Silas out there.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. That would have been really interesting. That's hard. I mean, those teams were really good. You know, they were, like, you know, 45 to 50 win teams. You know, they took the Lakers to, you know, a couple of tough playoff series in the late 60s.
Yeah.
So that is an interesting team right there. Yeah.
I'm with them. You know, the team I hope that it got Connie Hawkins, I'm going to St. Louis Hawks because they had that badass front court.
Yeah.
And also, as I said earlier, you would have had Hawkins with the Hawks. So I feel like that was a great marketing tool, too. They would have done it for that reason.
Yeah.
That's the perfect team that should have got him in 1964, the St. Louis Hawks.
Right. Plus, you would have had Pettit and Hawkins together for one season, at least, you know, before Pettit retires.
Yeah, that's right. That was his last year, so they still would have had Pettit for that last season.
Yeah, so that'd been fun.
Shit, that'd been the most stocked-ass front court ever. Yeah. Jesus. Like three Hall of Famers and then two more multiple-time All-Stars with Paul Silas and Bill Bridges. So.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Jesus. That's a heck of a team, yeah. Yeah, that, right. they had Chico Vaughn there, too. Yeah,
Chico, yes.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, nice. Yeah, and future, of course, as you mentioned, Paul Silas, a future teammate with Hawkins on the Suns. So a lot of connections that he would have later.
Yeah, that's a team that should have got him.
Yeah,
damn.
Yeah, and Bill Bridges, of course, he played with him with the Lakers. So a lot of future teammates on that team there.
Well, you know what? Actually, last little thing about the drafting. You know how the world works, and who really would have got him?
Probably Boston would have gotten him.
Yeah, Boston Celtics would have got him.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the way it would have worked back in the 60s. Aaron would have been too stupid. And
yeah,
Red Auerbach be like, well, so what? He took a little money on the side. Eh, he can play a bit small for it. Let's bring him in.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. They're great up until like 75 now. You know, or well, I guess they won the championship in 74, so they were good then. Yeah. But that like Hawkins keeps them like awesome for like another, you know, 5 years after Russell retires. I'm sure that's probably the universe that would have happened.
Yeah. They would have won it. They probably would have. Man, they probably would have beat Philly in 67.
Yeah, there you go. Right.
It's been a fight to the death.
Right.
Yeah, then in 70, 71, 72, wouldn't have been no rebuild. They just have Connie Hawkins still there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Hawkins and Havlicek. That's not too bad of a foundation to break on. They probably would have played really well together, too. Yeah. Well, there you go. So anything else we should talk about with Connie Hawkins before we go?
No, I think we got everything. Yeah. Honestly, I wish I would have been able to talk to him at one point. Seemed like I'm glad he wrote an autobiography. That's one thing I will say. I'm glad he wrote an autobiography in that era, like in early 70s. So he really kind of were able to capture how he felt at that time. So we'll always have that. Yeah, but it's always just, you know, always sucks when these guys pass away. Like, you know, that's, you're not going to get any more time to sit down and talk to those guys. But I think we've hit on everything, his influence and everything he did for basketball. I think we got all of it.
Well, Curtis, thank you so much. Always a pleasure to have you on the show, and always fun to talk about basketball history. We'll make sure we have something silly for you to get into next time. So we'll keep it a little bit less on a serious note. But so thanks a lot.
So I look forward to the Gene Banks podcast.
All right. Keep that one in mind. Absolutely. So thanks, everyone, for checking us out. Of course, you can find us at the Step Back at Fansided.com. You can also search for Over and Back on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you like what we do, please leave a rating and review. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. So until next time, thanks for listening. We'll be back again soon.